Perhaps I will return to Catatonia. I feel very lost, Louis.
Me too. Well, we've come 2,200 miles in the last 3 hours. We'd have done better with transfer booths or even stepping discs.
Our engineers were unable to arrange stepping discs.
The puppeteers' heads glanced at each other, eye to eye. A moment only they held the position, but Louis had seen that gesture before. Now, tentatively, he tagged it as puppeteer's laughter. Would a mad puppeteer develop a sense of humor? He continued speaking. We're moving to port. Speaker decided that the port side rim wall was closer. I think we could have flipped a coin for it and got better accuracy, but Speaker's the boss. He took over when you went catatonic.
That is unfortunate. Speaker's fly cycle is beyond range of my TASP. I must...
Hold it a second. Why not leave him in command?
But...
Think about it, Louis urged. You can always veto him with the TASP. If you don't put him in charge, he'll take over anyway every time you relax. We need an undisputed leader.
I suppose it cannot hurt, the puppeteer fluted. My leadership will not materially improve our chances.
That's the spirit. Call Speaker and tell him he's the hindmost. Louis hooked himself into Speaker's intercom to hear the exchange. If he was expecting fireworks, he was disappointed. The Kazin and the puppeteer spoke a few hissing, spitting phrases in the hero's tongue. Then the Kazin cut himself out of the circuit.
I must apologize, said Nessus. My stupidity has brought disaster on us.
Don't worry about it, Louis consoled him. You're just in the depressive leg of your cycle.
I am a sentient being, and I can face facts. I was terribly wrong about Teela Brown.
True enough, but that wasn't your fault.
It was indeed my fault, Louis Wu. I should have realized why I was having trouble finding candidates other than Teela Brown.
Huh?
They were too lucky.
Louis whistled tunelessly through his teeth. The puppeteer had evolved a brand new theory.
Specifically, said Nessus, they were too lucky to become involved in such a dangerous project as ours. The birthright lotteries have indeed produced psychic hereditary luck. Yet that luck was not available to me. When I tried to contact the lottery families, I found only Teela Brown.
Listen,
I was unable to contact others because they were too lucky. I was able to contact Teela Brown to involve her in this ill-fated expedition because she did not inherit the gene. Louis, I apologize.
Oh, go to sleep.
I must apologize to Teela, too.
No, that's my fault. I could have stopped her.
Could you?
I don't know. I honestly don't. Go to sleep.
I cannot.
Then you fly. I'll go to sleep. And so it was. But before Louis dropped off, he was surprised to realize how smoothly the fly cycle was riding. The puppeteer was an excellent pilot. Louis woke at first light. He was not used to sleeping under gravity. Never in his life had he spent a night in sitting position. When he yawned and tried to stretch, muscles seemed to crack and crumble under the strain. Groaning, he rubbed sticky eyes and looked about him. The shadows were funny. The light was funny. Louis looked up and found a white sliver of noonday sun. Stupid, he told himself as he waited for the tears to stop. His reflexes were faster than his brain. To his left, all was darkness, deepening with distance. The missing horizon was a blackness born of night and chaos, beneath a navy sky in which outlines of the ring-world arch glowed faintly. To the right, to spinward, was full day. Dawn was different on the ring-world. The desert was coming to an end, its weaving border, clear and sharp, curved away to right and left. Behind the cycles was desert, yellow-white and bright and barren. The big mountain still blocked an impressive chunk of sky. Ahead, rivers and lakes showed in diminishing perspective, separated by patches of green-brown. The cycles had maintained their positions, widely separated in a diamond pattern. At this distance, they seemed silver bugs, all alike. Louis was in the lead. His memory told him that Speaker had the spinward position, Nessus was to anti-spinward, and Teela brought up the rear. To spinward of the mountain was a hanging thread of dust, like a trail left by a ground-effect jeep crossing a desert, but larger. It had to be larger, though it was only a threat at this distance.
"Are you awake, Louis?"
"Morning, Nessus. Have you been flying all this time?"
"Some hours ago I turned that shore over to Speaker. You will notice that we have already traveled 7,000-odd miles."
"Yeah. But it was only a figure, a tiny fraction of the distance they would have to travel. A lifetime of using the transfer booth network had ruined Louis's sense of distance. "Look behind us," he said. "See that dust trail? Any idea what it might be?"
"Of course. It must be the vaporized rock from our meteoric landing, recondensed in the atmosphere. It has not had time to settle out of so large a volume."
"Oh, I was thinking of dust storms." "Tonge forever, look how far we slid." For the dust trail was at least a couple of thousand miles long, if it was as far away as the ship. Sky and Earth were two flat plates, infinitely wide, pressed together, and men were microbes crawling between the plates.
"Our air pressure has increased."
Louis pulled his eyes away from the vanishing point.
"What did you say?" "Look at your pressure gauge. We must have been at least 2 miles above our present level when we landed."
Louis dialed a ration brick for breakfast. "Is the air pressure important?"
"We must observe all things in an unfamiliar environment. One never knows what detail might be crucial. For instance, the mountain which we chose as a landmark bulks large behind us. It must be even larger than we thought. Again, what of that silver-shining point ahead of us?"
"Where?"
"Almost at the hypothetical horizon line, Louis. Directly ahead."
It was like searching out a single detail in a map seen edge-on. Louis found it anyway. A bright mirror gleam, just large enough to be more than a point. Reflected sunlight. What could it be, a glass city?
"Improbable."
Louis laughed. "You're too polite. It's as big as a glass city, though, or an acre of mirrors. Maybe it's a big telescope, reflector type."
"Then it has probably been abandoned."
"How so?"
"We know that this civilization has returned to savagery. Why else would they allow vast regions to return to desert?"
Once Louis had believed that argument. Now, "You may be oversimplifying. The ring world's bigger than we realized. I think there's room here for savagery and civilization, and anything in between."
"Civilization tends to spread, Louis."
"Yeah." They'd find out about the bright point anyway. It was directly in their path. There wasn't any coffee spigot. Louis was swallowing the last of his breakfast brick when he noticed two green lights glowing on his dashboard. They puzzled him until he remembered switching Tila and Speaker out of the intercom last night. He switched them back in.
"Good morning," said Speaker. "Did you see the dawn, Louis? It was artistically stimulating."
"I saw it." "Morning, Tila." Tila didn't answer. Louis looked more closely. Tila was fascinated, rapt, like one who has reached nirvana.
"Nessus, have you been using your TASP on my woman?"
"No, Louis, why should I?"
"How long has she been like this?"
"Like what?" Speaker demanded. "She's not been communicative recently, if that is what you mean."
"I mean her expression, Tangit."
Tila's image, poised on his dashboard, looked at infinity through the bulk of Louis' head. She was quietly, thoroughly happy.
"She seems relaxed," said the Kazin, "and in no discomfort. The finer nuances of human expression—"
"Never mind that. Land us, will you? She's got plateau trance."
"I do not understand."
"Just land us."
They fell from a mile up. Louis endured a queasy period of freefall before Speaker gave them thrust again. He watched Tila's image for her reaction, but he saw none. She was serene and undisturbed. The corners of her mouth turned very slightly up. Louis fumed as they dropped. He knew something about hypnosis. Bits and oddments of information such as a man will collect over 200 years of watching Tri-D. If only he could remember. Greens and browns resolved into field and forest and a silver thread of stream. It was lush, wild country below them, the kind of country flatlanders expect to find on a colony world. More's the pity.
"Try to put us in a valley," Louis told Speaker. "I'd like to get her out of sight of the horizon."
Very well. I suggest that you and Nessus cut yourselves out of autopilot and follow me down on manual. I will land Teela myself.
The diamond of flysickles broke up and reformed. Speaker moved port and spinward toward the stream Louis had spotted earlier. The others followed. They were still dropping as they crossed the stream. Speaker turned spinward to follow its course. By now he was virtually crawling through the air, moving just above the treetops. He searched for a stretch of bank not blocked by trees.
"The plants seem very Earth-like," said Louis.
The aliens made noises of agreement. They rounded a curve of stream. The natives were in the middle of a broad section of stream. They were working a fishing net. As the line of cycles came into view, the natives looked up. For a long moment, they did nothing more than let go of the net while they stared upward with their mouths open. Speaker, Louis, and Nessus all reacted in the same way. They took off straight upward. The natives dwindled to points, the stream to a winding silver thread. The lush wild forest blurred into green browns.
"Put yourself on autopilot," Speaker ordered in an unmistakable tone of command. "I will land us elsewhere."
He must have learned that tone of command, strictly for use in dealing with humans. The duties of an ambassador, Louis mused, were various indeed. Teela had apparently noticed nothing at all. Louis said, "Well?"
"They were men," said Nessus.
"They were, weren't they? I thought I might be hallucinating. How would men get here?" But nobody tried to answer. Chapter 12. Fist of God. They had landed in a pocket of wild country surrounded by low hills. With the hills hiding the mock horizon and the glow of the arch drowned by daylight, it might have been a scene on any human world. The grass was not precisely grass, but it was green, and it made a carpet over places that should have been covered by grass. There were soil and rocks, and bushes which grew green foliage and which were gnarled in almost the right ways. The vegetation, as Louis had remarked, was eerily earth-like. There were bushes where one would expect bushes, bare spots where one would expect bare spots. According to instruments in the scooters, the plants were earthly even at the molecular level. As Louis and Speaker were related by some remote viral ancestor, so the trees of this world could claim both as brother. There was a plant that would have made a nice hedge and or fence. It looked like wood. But it grew up at 45 degrees, sprouted a crown of leaves, dropped back at the same angle, sprouted a cluster of roots, rose again at 45 degrees. Louis had seen something like it on Gummidgee, but this row of triangles was glossy green and bark brown, the colors of earth life. Louis called it elbow root. Nessus moved about within the little pocket of forest, collecting plants and insects for testing in the compact laboratory of his scooter. He wore his vacuum suit, a transparent balloon with three boots and two glove and or mouthpieces. Nothing of the ring world could attack him without piercing that barrier. Not a predator, not an insect, not a grain of pollen, nor a fungus spore, nor a virus molecule. Teela Brown sat astride her flycycle, with her larger-than-delicate hands, resting slightly on the controls. The corners of her mouth curved slightly upward. She was poised against a flycycle's acceleration, relaxed yet alert, setting off the lines and curves of her body as if she were posing for a figure study. Her green eyes looked through Louis Wu, through a barrier of low hills, to see infinity at the ring world's abstract horizon.
"I do not understand," said Speaker. "Exactly what is the trouble? She is not asleep, yet she is curiously unresponsive."
"Highway hypnosis," said Louis Wu. "She'll come out of it by herself."
"Then she is in no danger?"
"Not now. I was afraid she might fall off her cycle or do something crazy with the controls. She's safe enough on the ground."
"But why does she take so little interest in us?"
Louis tried to explain. In the asteroid belt of Sol, men spend half their lives guiding single ships among the rocks. They take their positions from the stars. For hours at a time, a belt miner will watch the stars, the bright, quick arcs, which are fusion-driven single ships, the slow, drifting lights, which are nearby asteroids, and the fixed points, which are stars and galaxies. A man can lose his soul among the white stars. Much later, he may realize that his body has acted for him, guiding his ship while his mind traveled in realms he cannot remember. They call it the far look. It is dangerous. A man's soul does not always return. On the great flat plateau on Mount Lookatthat, a man may stand at the void edge and look down on infinity. The mountain is only 40 miles tall, but a human eye, tracing the mountain's fluted side, finds infinity on the solid mist that hides the mountain's base. The void mist is white and featureless and uniform. It stretches without change from the mountain's fluted flank to the world's horizon. The emptiness can snatch at a man's mind and hold it, so that he stands frozen and rapt at the edge of eternity until someone comes to lead him away. They call it plateau trance. Then there is the ring-world horizon. "But it's all self-hypnosis," said Louis. He looked into the girl's eyes. She stirred restlessly. "I could probably bring her out of it, but why risk it? Let her sleep."
"I do not understand hypnosis," said Speaker to Animals. "I know of it, but I do not understand it."
Louis nodded. "I'm not surprised. Kazinti wouldn't make good hypnotic subjects. Neither would puppeteers, for that matter." For Nessus had given over his collecting of samples of alien life and quietly joined them.
"We can study what we cannot understand," said the puppeteer. "We know that there is something in a man that does not want to make decisions. A part of him wants someone else to tell him what to do. A good hypnotic subject is a trusting person, with a good ability to concentrate. His act of surrender to the hypnotist is the beginning of his hypnosis."
"But what is hypnosis?"
"An induced state of monomania."
"But why would a subject go into monomania?"
Nessus apparently had no answer. Louis said, "Because he trusts the hypnotist." Speaker shook his great head and turned away.
"Such trust in another is insane. I confess I do not understand hypnosis," said Nessus. "Do you, Louis?"
"Not entirely."
"I am relieved," said the puppeteer,
and he looked for a moment into his own eyes, a pair of pythons inspecting each other.
"I could not trust one who could understand nonsense."
"What have you found out about ringworld plants?"
"They seem very like the life of Earth, as I told you. However, some of the forms seem more specialized than one would expect."
"More evolved, you mean?"
"Perhaps. Again, perhaps a specialized form has more room to grow, even within its limited environment, here on the ringworld. The important point is that the plants and insects are similar enough to attack us."
"And vice versa?"
"Oh, yes. A few forms are edible for me, a few others will fit your own belly. You will have to test them individually, first for poisons and then for taste. But any plant we find can safely be used by the kitchen on your cycle."
"We won't starve, then."
"This single advantage hardly compensates for the danger. If only our engineers had thought to peck a starseed lure aboard the Lyre, this entire trek would have been unnecessary."
"A starseed lure?"
"A simple device invented thousands of years ago. It causes the local sun to emit electromagnetic signals that attract starseeds. Had we such a device, we could lure a starseed to this star, then communicate our problem to any outsider ship that followed it inward."
"But starseeds travel at a lot less than light speed. It might take years."
"But think, Louis, however long we waited, we would not have to leave the safety of the ship."
"To you, this is a full life?" Louis snorted, and he glanced at Speaker, fixed on Speaker, locked eyes with Speaker. Speaker to Animals, curled on the ground some distance away, was staring back at him and grinning like an Alice in Wonderland Cheshire cat. For a long moment they locked eyes, and then the Kazin stood up with seeming leisure, sprang, and vanished into the alien bushes. Louis turned back. Somehow he knew that something important had happened, but what? And why? He shrugged it away. Straddling the contoured saddle of her cycle, Teela seemed braced for acceleration, as if she were still flying. Louis remembered the few times he had been hypnotized by a therapist. It had felt a lot like play-acting. Cushioned in a rosy absence of responsibility, he had known that it was all a game he was playing with the hypnotist. He could break free at any time, but somehow one never did. Teela's eyes cleared suddenly. She shook her head, turned, and saw them.
"Louis, how did we get down?"
"The usual way."
"Help me down."
She put her arms out like a child on a wall. Louis put his hands on her waist and lifted her from the cycle. The touch of her was a thrill along his back and an opening warmth in his groin and solar plexus. He left his hands where they were.
"The last I remember, we were a mile in the air," Teela said.
"From now on, keep your eyes off the horizon."
"What did I do, fall asleep at the wheel?"
She laughed and tossed her head so that her hair became a great soft black cloud.
"And you all panicked. I'm sorry, Louis. Where's Speaker?"
"Chasing a rabbit," said Louis. "Hey, why don't we get some exercise ourselves, now we've got the chance?"
"How about a walk in the woods?"
"Good idea." He met her eyes and saw that they had read each other's thoughts. He reached into his cycle's luggage bin and produced a blanket. "Ready?"
"You amaze me," said Nessus. "No known sentient species copulates as often as you do. Go, then. Use caution where you sit. Remember that unfamiliar life forms are about."
"Did you know," said Louis, "that naked once meant the same thing as unprotected?" For it seemed to him that he was removing his safety with his clothes. The Ringworld was a functioning biosphere, ripe, no doubt, with bugs and bacteria and toothy things built to eat protoplasmic meat.
"No,"
said Teela. She stood naked on the blanket and stretched her arms to the noon sun.
"It feels good."
"Do you know that I've never seen you naked in daylight?"
"Likewise. I might add that you look tonge good that way. Here, let me show you something."
He half raised a hand to his hairless chest.
"Tonge it?"
"I don't see anything."
"It's gone. That's the trouble with booster spice. No memories. The scars disappear, and after a while—"
He traced a line across his chest, but there was nothing under his fingertip.
"A gummagey reacher tore a strip off me from shoulder to navel, 4 inches wide and half an inch deep. His next pass would have split me in two. He decided to swallow what he had of me first. I must have been deadly poison to him because he curled up in a shrieking ball and died. Now there's nothing, not a mark on me anywhere."
"Poor Louis. But I don't have any marks either."
"But you're a statistical anomaly, and furthermore, you're only 20 years old."
"Oh.
You are smooth."
"Any other missing memories?"
I made a mistake with a mining beam once."
He guided her hand. Presently, Louis rolled onto his back, and Teela impaled herself as she straddled his hips. They looked at each other for a long, brilliant, unbearable moment before they began to move. Seen through the glow of a building orgasm, a woman seems to blaze with angelic glory. Something the size of a rabbit shot out of the trees, scampered across Louis's chest, and was gone into the undergrowth. An instant later, Speaker to Animals bounded into view.
"Excuse me," the Kazin called, and was gone, hot on the scent.
When they reconvened at the cycles, the fur around Speaker's mouth was stained red.
"For the first time in my life," he proclaimed with quiet satisfaction, "I have hunted for my food, using no more weapons than my own teeth and claws."
But he still followed Nessus's advice and took a broad-spectrum allergy pill.
"It is time we discussed the natives," said Nessus.
Teela looked startled.
"Natives?"
Louis explained.
"But why did we run? How could they have heard us? Were they really human?"
Louis answered the last question because it had been bothering him.
"I don't see how they could have been. What would human beings be doing this far from human space?"
"There is no possible doubt of that," Speaker interjected. "Trust your senses, Louis. We may find that their race differs from yours or Teela's, but they are human."
"What makes you so sure?"
"I smell them, Louis. The scent reached me when we turned off the sonic folds. Far away, thinly spread, a vast multitude of human beings. Trust my nose, Louis."
Louis accepted it. The Kazinti nose was worn by a hunting carnivore. He suggested, "Parallel evolution?"
"Nonsense," said Nessus.
"Right."
The human shape was convenient for a toolmaker, but not more so than other configurations. Minds came in all kinds of bodies.
We are wasting time, said Speaker to Animals. The problem is not how men arrived here. The problem is one of first contact. For us, every contact will be a first contact.
He was right, Louis realized. The cycles moved faster than any information-sending device the natives were likely to have. Unless they had semaphores.
Speaker continued, We need to know something of the behavior of humans in the savage state. Louis, Teela?
I know a little anthropology, said Louis.
Then when we make contact, you will speak for us. Let us hope that our autopilot makes an adequate translator. We will contact the first humans we find.
They were barely in the air, it seemed, when the forest gave way to a checkerboard of cultivated fields. Seconds later, Teela spotted the city. It resembled some earthly cities of previous centuries. There were a great many buildings a few stories tall, packed shoulder to shoulder in a continuous mass. A few tall, slender towers rose above the mass, and these were joined together by winding ground car ramps, definitely not a feature of earthly cities. Earth's cities of that era had tended to heliports instead.
Perhaps our search ends here, Speaker suggested hopefully.
Bet you it's empty, said Louis.
He was only guessing, but he was right. It became obvious as they flew over.
In its day, the city must have been terrible in its beauty. One feature it had which would have been the envy of any city in known space. Many of the buildings had not rested on the ground at all, but had floated in the air, joined to the ground and to other buildings by ramps and elevator towers. Free of gravity, free of vertical and horizontal restrictions, these floating dream castles had come in all shapes and a wide choice of sizes. Now four fly cycles flew over the wreckage. Every floating building had smashed lower buildings when it fell, so that all was shattered brick and glass and concrete, torn steel, twisted ramps and elevator towers still reaching into the air. It made Louis wonder again about the natives. Human engineers didn't build air castles. They were too safety-conscious.
They must have fallen all at once, said Nessus. I see no sign of attempted repairs. A power failure, no doubt.
Speaker, would Kazinti build so foolishly?
We do not love heights so well. Humans might, if they did not so love their lives.
Booster spice, Louis exclaimed. That's the answer. They didn't have booster spice.
Yes, that might make them less safety-conscious. They would have less of life to protect, the puppeteer speculated. That seems ominous, does it not? If they think less of their own lives, they will think less of ours.
You're borrowing trouble.
We will know soon enough, Speaker. Do you see that last building? The tall, cream-colored one with the broken windows?
They had passed over it while the puppeteer spoke. Louis, who was taking his turn at flying the cycles, circled for another look.
I was right. You see, Speaker? Smoke.
The building was an artistically twisted and sculpted pillar some 20 stories tall. Its windows were rows of black ovals. Most of the windows of the ground floor were covered. The few that were open poured thin gray smoke into the wind. The tower stood ankle-deep among one- and two-story homes. A row of those homes had been smashed flat by a rolling cylinder which must have fallen from the sky. But the rolling wreckage had disintegrated into concrete rubble before it reached that single tower. The back of the tower was the edge of the city. Beyond were only rectangles of cultivation. Humanoid figures were running in from the fields, even as the fly cycles settled. Buildings which had looked whole from high up were obvious wrecks at rooftop level. Nothing was untouched. The power failure and its accompanying disasters must have occurred generations ago. Then had come vandalism, rain, all the various corrosions caused by small life forms, oxidation of metals, and something more. Something that in Earth's prehistoric past had left village mounds for later archaeologists to browse through. The city dwellers had not restored their city after the power failure. Neither had they moved away. They had lived on in the ruins. And the garbage of their living had accumulated about them. Garbage. Empty boxes, wind-borne dust, inedible parts of food, bones, and things comparable to carrot leaves and corn cobs. Broken tools. it built up when people were too lazy or too hard-worked to haul the rubbish away. It built up, and the parts softened and merged, and the pile settled under its own weight and was compressed further by heavy feet, year by year, generation by generation. The original entrance to the tower was already buried. Ground level had risen that far. As the fly cycles settled on hard-packed dirt, 10 feet above what had once been a parking area for large ground-bound vehicles, 5 humanoid natives strode in solemn dignity through a second-story window. The window was a double bay window, easily large enough to accommodate such a procession. Its sill and lintel were decorated with 30 or 40 human-looking skulls. Louis could see no obvious pattern to their arrangement. The 5 walked toward the cycles. As they came near, they hesitated, in visible doubt as to who was in charge. They too looked human, but not very. Clearly they belonged to no known race of man. The 5 were all shorter than Louis Wu by 6 inches or more. Where it showed, their skin was very light, almost ghost-white in contrast to Tila's merely Nordic pink or Louis's darker yellow-brown. They tended to short torsos and long legs. They walked with their arms identically folded, and their fingers were extraordinarily long and tapering, so that any of the 5 would have been a born surgeon in the days when men still performed surgery. Their hair was more extraordinary than their hands. On all 5 dignitaries, it was the same shade of ash blonde. They wore their hair and beards combed but uncut, and their beards covered their faces entirely, except for the eyes. Needless to say, they all looked alike.
"They're so hairy," Tila whispered.
"Stay on your vehicles," Speaker ordered in a low voice. "Wait until they reach us, then dismount. I assume we are all wearing our communicator discs?" Louis wore his inside his left wrist. The discs were linked to the autopilot aboard the Lyre. They should work over such a distance, and the Lyre's autopilot should be able to translate any new language. But there was no way to test the Tanj things except in action. And there were all those skulls. Other natives were pouring into the former parking lot. Most of them halted at the sight of the confrontation in progress, so that the crowd formed a wide, rough circle well outside the region of action. A normal crowd would have grumbled to itself in speculation and wagers and arguments. This crowd was unnaturally silent. Perhaps the presence of an audience forced the dignitaries to decide. They chose to approach Louis Wu. The 5, they didn't really look alike. They differed in height. All were thin, but one was almost a skeleton, and one almost had muscles. 4 wore shapeless, almost colorless brown robes. A 5th wore a robe of similar cut, cut from a similar blanket, but in a faded pink pattern. The one who spoke was the thinnest of them. A blue tattooed bird adorned the back of his hand. Louis answered. The tattooed one made a short speech. That was luck. The autopilot would need data before it could begin a translation. Louis replied. The tattooed man spoke again. His 4 companions maintained their dignified silence. So, incredibly, did their audience. Presently, the discs were filling in words and phrases. He thought later that the silence should have tipped him off. It was their stance that fooled him. There was the wide ring of the crowd, and the 4 hairy men in robes, all standing in a row, and the man with the tattooed hand, talking.
"We call the mountain Fist of God."
He was pointing directly starboard.
"Why? Why not, if it please you, engineer?"
He must have meant the big mountain, the one they had left behind with the ship. By now it was entirely concealed by haze and distance. Louis listened and learned. The autopilot made a dandy translator. Gradually a picture built up, a picture of a farming village living in the ruins of what had once been a mighty city.
"True, Zignamu Click-Click is no longer as great as it once was, yet our dwellings are far superior to what we could make for ourselves. Where a roof is open to the sky, still the lower floor will remain dry during a short rainstorm. The buildings of the city are easy to keep warm. In time of war they are easily defended and difficult to burn down. So it is, engineer, that though we go in the morning to work our fields, at night we return to our dwellings along the edge of Zignamu Click-Click. Why should we strain to make new homes when the old ones serve better?"
two terrifying aliens and two almost humans, unbearded and unnaturally tall, all four riding wingless metal birds, speaking gibberish from their mouths and sense from metal discs. Small wonder if the natives had taken them for the Ringworld builders. Louis did nothing to correct the impression. An explanation of their origin would have taken days, and the team was here to learn, not to teach.
"This tower, engineer, is our seat of government. We rule more than 1,000 people here. Could we raise a better palace than this tower? We have blocked off the upper stories so that the sections we use will retain heat. Once we defended the tower by dropping rubble from the upper floors. I remember that our worst problem was the fear of high places. Yet we long for the return of the days of wonder when our city held 1,000,000 people and buildings floated in the air. We hope that you will choose to bring back those days. It is said that in the days of wonder, even this very world was bent to its present shape. Perhaps you will deign to say if it is true."
"It's true enough," said Louis.
"And shall those days return?"
Louis made an answer he hoped was noncommittal. He sensed the other's disappointment, or guessed it. Reading the hairy man's expression was not easy. Gestures are a kind of code, and the spokesman's gestures were not those of any terrestrial culture. Tightly curled platinum hair hid his entire face, except for the eyes, which were brown and soft. But eyes hold little expression, contrary to public opinion. His voice was almost a chant, almost a recital of poetry. The autopilot was translating Louis's words into a similar chant, though it spoke to Louis in a conversational tone. Louis could hear the other translator discs whistling softly in puppeteer, snarling quietly in the hero's tongue. Louis put questions.
"No, engineer, we are not a bloodthirsty people. We make war rarely. The skulls? They lie underfoot, wherever one walks in Zignamu Click-Click. They have been there since the fall of the city, it is said. We use them for decoration and for their symbolic significance."
The spokesman solemnly raised his hand with its back to Louis, presenting the bird tattoo. And everyone in sight shouted. The word was not translated. It was the first time anyone but the spokesman had said anything at all. Louis had missed something, and he knew it. Unfortunately, there wasn't time to worry about it.
"Show us a wonder," the spokesman was saying. "We doubt not your power, but you may not pass this way again. We would have a memory to pass to our children."
Louis considered. They'd already flown like birds. That trick would not impress twice. What about manna from the kitchen slots? But even earthborn humans varied in their tolerance of certain food. The difference between food and garbage was mostly cultural. Some ate locusts with honey, others broiled snails. One man's cheese was another's rotted milk. Best not chance it. What about the flashlight laser? As Louis reached into his cycle's cargo kit, the first edge of a shadow square touched the rim of the sun. Darkness would make his demonstration all the more impressive. With aperture wide and power low, he turned the light first on the spokesman, then on his four co-rulers, last on the faces of the crowd. If they were impressed, they hid it well. Hiding his disappointment, Louis aimed the implement high. The figurine, which was his target, jutted from the tower's roof. It was like a modernized, surrealistic gargoyle. Louis's thumb moved, and the gargoyle glowed yellow-white. His index finger shifted, and the beam narrowed to a pencil of green light. The gargoyle sprouted a white-hot navel. Louis waited for the applause.
"You fight with light," said the man with the tattooed hand. "Surely this is forbidden."
The crowd shouted again and was as suddenly silent.
"We did not know it," said Louis. "We apologize."
"Did not know it? How could you not know it? Did you not raise the arch in sign of the covenant with man?"
"What arch is that?"
The hairy man's face was hidden, but his astonishment was evident.
"The arch over the world, O builder!"
Louis understood then. He started to laugh. The hairy man punched him unskillfully in the nose. The blow was light, for the hairy man was slight and his hands were fragile. But it hurt. Louis was not used to pain. Most people of his century had never felt pain more severe than that of a stubbed toe. Anesthetics were too prevalent. Medical help was too easily available. The pain of a skier's broken leg usually lasted seconds, not minutes, and the memory was often suppressed as an intolerable trauma. Knowledge of the fighting disciplines, karate, judo, jiu-jitsu, and boxing, had been illegal since long before Louis Wu was born. Louis Wu was a lousy warrior. He could face death, but not pain. The blow hurt. Louis screamed and dropped his flashlight laser. The audience converged. 200 infuriated hairy men became 1,000 demons, and things weren't nearly as funny as they had been a minute ago. The reed-thin spokesman had wrapped both arms around Louis Wu, pinioning him with hysterical strength. Louis, equally hysterical, broke free with one frantic lunge. He was on his cycle, his hand was on the lift lever, when reason prevailed. The other cycles were slave to his. If he took off, they would take off, with or without their passengers. Louis looked about him. Teela Brown was already in the air. From overhead, she watched the fight, her eyebrows puckered in concern. She had not thought of trying to help. Speaker was in furious motion. He'd already felled 6 enemies. As Louis watched, the Kazin swung his flashlight laser and smashed a man's skull. The hairy men milled about him in an indecisive circle. Long-fingered hands were trying to pull Louis from his seat. They were winning, though Louis gripped the saddle with hands and knees. Belatedly, he thought to switch on the sonic fold. The natives shrieked as they were snatched away. Someone was still on Louis's back. Louis pulled him away, let him drop, flipped the sonic fold off, and then on again to eject him. He scanned the X parking lot for Nessus. Nessus was trying to reach his cycle. The natives seemed to fear his alien shape. Only one blocked his way, but that one was armed with a metal rod from some old machine. As Louis located them, the man swung the rod at the puppeteer's head. Nessus snatched his head back. He spun on his forelegs, putting his back to danger, but facing away from his fly cycle. The puppeteer's own flight reflex had killed him, unless Speaker or Louis could help him in time. Louis opened his mouth to shout, and the puppeteer completed his motion. Louis closed his mouth. The puppeteer turned to his cycle. Nobody tried to stop him. His hind hoof left bloody footprints across the hard-packed dirt. Speaker's circle of admirers were still out of his reach. The Kazin spat at their feet, not a Kazinti gesture but a human one, turned and mounted his cycle. His flashlight laser was gory up to the elbow of his left hand. The native who had tried to stop Nessus lay where he had fallen. Blood pooled lavishly about him. The others were in the air. Louis took off after them. From afar he saw what Speaker was doing, and he called, "Hold it! That's not necessary!" Speaker had drawn the modified digging tool. He said, "Does it have to be necessary?" But he had stayed his hand. "Don't do it," Louis implored him. "It'd be murder. How can they hurt us now? Throw rocks at us?"
"They may use your flashlight laser against us."
"They can't use it at all. There's a taboo."
"So said the spokesman. Do you believe him?"
"Yeah." Speaker put his weapon away. Louis sighed in relief. He'd expected the Kazin to level the city.
"How would such a taboo evolve? A war of energy weapons?"
"Or a bandit armed with the Ringworld's last laser cannon. Too bad there's nobody to ask."
"Your nose is bleeding."
Now that he came to think about it, Louis's nose stung painfully. He slaved his cycle to Speaker's and set about making medical repairs. Below, a churning, baffled lynch mob swarmed at the outskirts of Zignamuklikklik. Chapter 13. Starseed Lure.
"They should have been kneeling," Louis complained. "That's what fooled me. And the translation kept saying Builder when it should have been saying God."
"God? They've made gods of the Ringworld engineers. I should have noticed the silence. Tanjit, nobody but the priest was making a sound. They all acted like they were listening to some old litany. Except that I kept giving the wrong responses."
"A religion? How weird.
But you shouldn't have laughed," Tila's intercom image said seriously. "Nobody laughs in church, not even tourists." They flew beneath a fading sliver of noon sun. The ring world showed above itself in glowing blue stripes, brighter every minute.
"It seemed funny at the time," said Louis. "It's still funny. They've forgotten they're living on a ring. They think it's an arch."
A rushing sound penetrated the sonic fold. For a moment it was a hurricane, then it cut off sharply. They had crossed the speed of sound.
Zignamu Click-Click dwindled behind them. The city would never have its vengeance on the demons. Probably it would never see them again.
"It looks like an arch," said Teela.
"Right. I shouldn't have laughed. We're lucky, though. We can leave our mistakes behind us," said Louis. "All we have to do any time is get airborne. Nothing can catch us."
"Some mistakes we must carry with us," said Speaker to Animals.
"Funny you should say so."
Louis scratched absently at his nose, which was as numb as a block of wood. It would be healed before the anesthetic wore off. He made up his mind.
"Nessus?"
"Yes, Louis."
"I realized something back there. You've been claiming that you're insane because you demonstrate courage, right?"
"How tactful you are, Louis. Your delicacy of tongue..."
"Be serious. You and all the other puppeteers have been making the same wrong assumption. A puppeteer instinctively turns to run from danger, right?"
"Yes, Louis."
"Wrong. A puppeteer instinctively turns away from danger. It's to free his hind leg for action. That hoof makes a deadly weapon, Nessus."
All in one motion, the puppeteer had spun on his forelegs and lashed out with his single hind leg. His heads were turned backward and spread wide, Louis remembered, to triangulate on his target. Nessus had accurately kicked a man's heart out through his splintered spine.
"I could not run," he said. "I would have been leaving my vehicle. That would have been dangerous."
"But you didn't stop to think about it," said Louis. "It was instinctive. You automatically turned your back on an enemy. Turn and kick. A sane puppeteer turns to fight, not to run. You're not crazy."
"You are wrong, Louis. Most puppeteers run from danger."
"But
the majority is always sane, Louis."
"Herd animal." Louis gave it up. He lifted his eyes to watch the last sliver of sun disappear. "Some mistakes we must carry with us."
But Speaker must have been thinking of something else when he said that.
Thinking of what?
At the zenith swarmed a ring of black rectangles. The one that hid the sun was framed in a pearly coronal glow. The blue ring world formed a paraboloid arch over it all, framed against a star-dotted sky. It looked like something done with a build-a-city set by a child too young to know what he was doing. Nessus had been steering when they left Zignamu Click-Click. Later he had turned the fleet over to Speaker. They had flown all night. Now, overhead, a brighter glow along one edge of the central shadow square showed that dawn was near. Sometime during these past hours, Louis had found a way to visualize the scale of the ring world. It involved a Mercator projection of the planet Earth, a common rectangular classroom wall map, but with the equator drawn to 1:1 scale. One could relief sculpt such a map so that standing near the equator would be exactly like standing on the real Earth, but one could draw 40 such maps edge to edge across the width of the ring world. Such a map would be greater in area than the Earth, but one could map it into the ring world's topography and look away for a moment and never be able to find it again. One could play cuter tricks than that given the tools that shape the ring world. Those matching salt oceans, one on each side of the ring, had each been larger in area than any world in human space. Continents, after all, were only large islands. One could map the Earth onto such an ocean and still have room left over at the borders.
"I shouldn't have laughed," Louis told himself.
"It took me long enough to grasp the scale of this artifact. Why should I expect the natives to be more sophisticated?"
Nessus had seen it earlier. Night before last, when they had first seen the arch, Nessus had screamed and tried to hide.
"Oh, what the tonge!"
It didn't matter. Not when all mistakes could be left behind at 1,200 miles per hour. Presently, Speaker called and turned control of the fleet over to Louis. Louis flew while Speaker slept. And dawn came on at 700 miles per second. The line dividing day from night is called the Terminator. On Earth, the Terminator is visible from the moon. It is visible from orbit. But it cannot be seen from the Earth's surface. But the straight lines dividing light from dark on the arch of the ring world were all Terminators. From spinward, the Terminator line swept toward the Flycycle fleet. From ground to sky it ran, from infinity port to infinity starboard. It came on like destiny made visible, a moving wall too big to go around. It arrived. The corona brightened overhead, then blazed as the withdrawing shadow square exposed a rim of solar disk. Louis contemplated the night to his left, the day on his right, the Terminator shadow receding across an endless plain. A strange dawn, staged for Louis Wu the tourist. Far to starboard, beyond where the land turned to haze, the sharp outlines of a mountain peak materialized in the new daylight. "Fist of God," said Louis Wu, tasting the rolling sound of it in his mouth. What a name for a mountain. But especially what a name for the greatest mountain in the world. Louis Wu, the man, ached. If his body didn't begin adjusting soon, his joints would freeze him in sitting position, and he'd never move again. Furthermore, his food bricks were beginning to taste like bricks. Moreover, his nose was still partly numb, and there still wasn't any coffee spigot. But Louis Wu, the tourist, was being royally entertained. Take the puppeteer flight reflex. Nobody had ever suspected that it might also be a fighting reflex. Nobody but Louis Wu. Take the starseed lure. What a poetic thing to leave lying about. A simple device invented thousands of years ago, Nessus had said, and no puppeteer had ever thought to mention it until yesterday. But puppeteers are so completely unpoetic. Did the puppeteers know why outsider ships followed starseeds? Did they gloat in the knowledge? Or had they learned that secret, then discarded it as irrelevant to the business of living forever? Nessus was out of the intercom circuit. Asleep, probably. Louis signaled him so that the puppeteer would see the light on his panel and call him when he woke. Did he know? Starseeds, mindless beings who swarmed in the galactic core. Their metabolism was the solar phoenix. Their food was the thinly spread hydrogen of interstellar space. Their motive power was a photon sail, enormous and highly reflective, controlled like a skydiver's parachute. A starseed's egg-laying flight commonly took it from the galactic axis out to the edge of intergalactic space, and then back, without the egg. The hatched starseed chick must find its own way home, riding the photon wind to the warm, hydrogen-rich core. Where the starseeds went, there went the outsiders. Why did outsiders follow starseeds? Whimsical question, though poetic. Maybe not so whimsical. Back around the middle of the first Man-Kazin War, a starseed had zigged instead of zagging. The outsider ship following it had cruised past Procyon, had paused long enough to sell We Made It, a hyperdrive shunt. The ship could as easily have wandered into Kazinti instead of human space. And hadn't the puppeteers been studying the Kazinti about that time? Tangit, that's what I get for letting my mind wander. Discipline, that's what I need. But hadn't they? Sure they had. Nessus had said so. The puppeteers had been researching the Kazinti, investigating whether they could be exterminated safely. Then the Man-Kazin War had solved their problem. An outsider ship had wandered into human space to sell We Made It a hyperdrive shunt, while the Kazinti Armada was sweeping inward from the opposite border. Once human warships had the hyperdrive shunt, the Kazinti had ceased to be a threat to man and puppeteer alike. They wouldn't dare, Louis told himself. He was appalled. If Speaker ever... But that possibility was even worse. An experiment in selective breeding, said Louis. Selective, there ain't no justice breeding. But they used us. They used us. Yes, said Speaker to animals.
For an instant, Louis was sure he had imagined it. Then he saw Speaker's transparent miniature image at the top of his dashboard. He had left the intercom open.
Tanch for torment. You were listening.
Not by choice, Louis. I neglected to switch off my intercom.
Oh.
Too late, Louis remembered Speaker grinning at him, supposedly out of hearing range, after Nessus had finished describing a starseed lure. Remembered that Kazinti ears were made to serve a hunting carnivore. Remembered that the Kazinti smile reflex is intended to free the teeth for battle.
You mentioned selective breeding, said Speaker.
Well, I was just...
Louis floundered.
The puppeteers pitted our species against each other in order to restrict Kazinti expansion. They had a starseed lore, Louis. They used it to guide an outsider ship into your space, to ensure human victory. An experiment in selective breeding, you called it.
Listen, that's a very chancy chain of assumptions. If you'll just calm down...
But we both followed that chain.
Hmm.
I was in doubt as to whether to broach the subject to Nessus, or whether to wait until we had accomplished our major objective, which is to leave the ring world. Now that you know the situation, I have no choice.
But...
Louis closed his mouth.
The siren would have drowned him out anyway.
Speaker had signaled emergency. The siren was a maniac mechanical scream, a subsonic and supersonic and jarringly painful sound. Nessus appeared above the dash, crying, "Yes? Yes?"
Speaker roared his answer. You have meddled in a war in the enemy's favor. Your action is tantamount to a declaration of war against the patriarchy.
Tila had cut in time to hear the last part. Louis caught her eye, shook his head. Don't mix in. The puppeteer's heads reared like snakes to show his astonishment. His voice was without inflection as usual.
What are you talking about?
The first war with men. Starseed lures. The outsider hyperdrive shunt.
A triangular head dipped out of sight. Louis watched a silver fly cycle drop out of formation and knew it was Nessus. He was not terribly worried. The other two fly cycles looked like silver midges, so far away were they, and so far apart. If the fight had taken place on the ground, someone could have been seriously hurt. Up here, what could happen? The puppeteer's fly cycle had to be faster than Speaker's. Nessus would have seen to that. He would have made certain he could outrun a Kazin when necessary. Except that the puppeteer wasn't fleeing. He was looping around at Speaker's cycle.
I do not wish to kill you, said Speaker to animals. If you intend to attack from the air, you should remember that the range of your TASP may be less than the range of the slaver digging beam. Snarl!
The Kazinti killing yell was blood-freezing. Louis's muscles locked in position as with tetanus. He was only dimly aware of the silver dot that looped away from Speaker's cycle. But he did notice Tila's look of open-mouthed admiration.
I do not intend to kill you, Speaker to Animals said more calmly. But I will have answers, Nessus. We know that your race can guide starseeds.
Yes, said Nessus.
His cycle was receding to port at improbable speed. The feral calm of the aliens was an illusion. It existed only because Louis Wu could not read expression in an alien face, and because the aliens could not put human expression into the interworld language. Nessus was fleeing for his life, but the Kazin had not left his place in formation. He said,
I will have answers, Nessus.
You have guessed correctly, said the puppeteer. Our investigation of safe methods to exterminate the vicious, carnivorous Kazinti showed that your species has a high potential, that you could conceivably be of use to us. We took steps to evolve you to the point where you could deal peaceably with races alien to you. Our methods were indirect and very safe.
Very. Nessus, I am not happy.
Neither am I, said Louis Wu.
He had not missed the fact that both aliens were still speaking interworld. They could have had privacy by using the hero's tongue. They had preferred to include the humans, and quite rightly, for it was Louis Wu's quarrel, too.
You used us, he said. You used us just as thoroughly as you used the Kazinti.
But to our detriment, Speaker objected.
A number of men were killed in the Man-Kazin Wars.
Louis, get off his back.
Tila Brown entered the lists of battle.
Tanjit, if it hadn't been for the puppeteers, we'd all be Kzinti slaves. They kept the Kzinti from destroying civilization.